take it away.
Pleasure. Thank you. Hello. Welcome. As Bruce says, I'm Dr. Tracy Price. This is my 8th year as Dean of Education here at Table. And I've just picked up the Dean of Humanities and Social Sciences role as well. I'd like to say that it came with a massive pay rise and a few other perks, but unfortunately it didn't. We're doing it to create some succession. So we've also put in place now some deputy deans, and part of my role is going to be sort of a mentoring role. So hopefully I won't lose my sanity in the process. I think it's always good to know a little bit about the person who is speaking. So my ideas come from my background in education, but before I was an educator, secondary teacher for a long time in English and politics, I was a prison officer in maximum security male prisons. So I found that was excellent preparation for teaching teenagers and found usually very few behaviour management problems in my classrooms. I love this conference. It's been fantastic. I love the whole, here's a couple of ideas, here's something, here's, you know, go away and think about this, see how it all blends in together. Some of the conversations, you know, sort of in between sessions, I think have been the best. I wrote this paper with the idea of a spiritual focus on Christian truths and how that kind of a focus might revive those traditional truths, but particularly in relation to how they might revive the truths of the essence of God. Who is God? And enable renewed understandings of their relevance in a postmodern context. And I think it's prompted for me mainly by the struggle that I see with a lot of my Christian students here. You know, they have this sense that they believe in absolute truths, they believe in absolute morals, but they're not able to live them absolutely. And so there's this tension all the time. And I wonder if the answer partly lies in the idea of a Christian spiritual approach. David Tacey reminds us that faith in Christ is a foundation, but it needs a spiritual focus to renew our understandings of the essence of God. And therein we can find some sense of what truth is and how we might live it. This kind of a spiritual focus invites us to engage with Christian ethical or moral concepts in a way that I think enables nuanced and critical understandings. And it forms a basis for development of an ethical framework that we can apply to our lives. And I particularly focus that in my work through the idea of people-focused work. So we have here at Table counsellors, teachers, you know, musicians, youth workers, people who are literally going into those people-focused professions. Employing a biblical frame, an ethical framework, I think, to those biblical beliefs gives us that sense of a deeper understanding and the chance to really spiritually work out what those truths are through our life and work. And so this session is going to look at just two ethical components that contribute to the building of an ethical framework. We give three-hour lectures here at Table, and they're kind of interactive workshop sort of lectures, and these are the kinds of ideas that we look at, so strap yourselves in. Two things I want to look at. Obviously, you could write a thesis about both of these. We're not going to have opportunity for that. It's too, we talked before about whetting your appetite for something. And so I want to talk about just this idea of an ethics idea about graded absolutism theory, but also a biblical characteristic of hospitality and how the two things might combine as an ethical framework to help us live Christian spiritual lives. My own interest obviously comes from my vocational work as an ethics lecturer, as somebody who's interested in things like spirituality, justice, pedagogical understandings, and so on. I was reminded recently of the significance of the ethical understanding that comes through stories, others and our own. And so today I'm going to use the story, the biblical story of Rahab, as an example of courageous embodiment of spiritual understanding. And I think we'll find that both of these concepts, graded absolutism and hospitality, come through in that story. So the key point of Rahab's story is that she acted ethically and decisively because of a spiritual insight that she had into the essence of God. She understood deeper spiritual truths, that God is God, that God is with his people, and more importantly, that God's hospitality extended to herself. And because Rahab trusted and believed, she courageously stepped outside the bounds of her cultural religion, acted hospitably, and was saved. In fact, more than that, Rahab's entire family were literally and spiritually saved when all else perished, and Rahab was honoured later amongst the greats of faith. So let's have a little look at that story. Normally I would get my Bible out and we'd go through and we'd have a little look at this, but let's begin with the basics. Joshua and the Israelites are about to enter the Promised Land. So it's the end of the Exodus. The Jews are coming out of slavery. The Israelites are coming out of slavery. It's the end of the Exodus journey for God's chosen people. And it's as far as Moses gets. So the leadership is handed on to Joshua. And he sends out spies across the Jordan River to Jericho, the Promised Land. The spies enter the house. In some texts, this is described as a public house or an inn, which may well also have been a brothel, of Rahab. She's a prostitute. She seems, however, to know their God. She seems to know why they are there. She's a Canaanite, worshipping a different God. The entire city is a walled city. She hides them. And she lies to the king's soldiers when they come looking. No, I haven't seen them. Yes, they were here before, but they've gone off now. If you go and search that side of the city gates, you may find them. So she sends the soldiers out the city gates. At night time, the city gates are closed. The soldiers are left outside. The spies, in the meantime, get the opportunity to escape. In turn for doing that act of hospitality, she asks that her family will be saved when they take the land. The spies agree, but they say to her, your entire household needs to be inside your house, and there needs to be a scarlet cord in the window when we come back to take Jericho. So remember her context. She's a Canaanite. She's of a Gentile culture that worships idols. Her act of hospitality here is also an act of treason. It's an offence resulting in death. Now, her decisions are not taken lightly, and nor, would I presume, are they taken without some kind of spiritual insight into who God actually is, the essence of God. 3 days later, the consequences emerge. The Israelites take over. They wander around the city gates. They sing songs, worshipping God until the walls collapse. They come in. They take over everything. They raise everything to the ground, except Rahab and her family. So a legalistic, theistic interpretation of these events might say that innocent and unsuspecting people perished because Rahab rejected the idols and believed in another god against her religion. She deliberately broke a commandment by lying. She committed treason against her king and fellow countrymen, said nothing, gave no warning. And in light of those sort of awful outcomes, it seems unreasonable to label Rahab's decisions and actions as hospitably and ethically good. It would be more likely that she deserved punishment. Yet from a graded absolutist interpretation, and we'll look at that a bit more in a minute, the opposite holds true. And this is evident, I think, in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 is often known as the faith chapter. In this chapter, it's the litany of the greats of faith. This historical record summarises God's people considered to be greats of Christian faith, those who honoured God, who obeyed God, those whom God lauded as righteous. And in that same list, Rahab is included. Hebrews 11 explains that being faith is sure of what we hope for, certain of what we do not see, and so on, commends the greats. Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain, but by faith he was commended as a righteous man. By faith Enoch was taken from life, even though he did not experience death. By faith Noah, by faith Moses, by faith David, by faith. Verse 29 reminds that by faith and the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. When the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. Verse 30, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around them. Verse 31, by faith, the prostitute Rahab is made righteous and was not killed with those who were disobedient because she welcomed the spies. So Rahab then is a great example of the power of hospitality, even at great risk to oneself. And I'm making the argument that this was the kind of faith that Rahab showed was an absolutist, a graded absolutist kind of faith. Graded absolutism, in a snapshot, is an ethical theory that enables humans to live the essence of an absolute truth in an imperfect and relative world. The study of ethics generally is broad, very broad. Give us 3 years and we might get somewhere. So if we look at the idea of ethical philosophies, we would tend to look at this generalised idea, and I'm being very general and very simplistic here, in this sense that there is a kind of a theistic view and a humanistic view. Either God exists or God doesn't exist. Either there is some supernatural power that has created and therefore has truth and law, or it is all based on humans. So if we look at that kind of little dichotomy there, you've got this idea of, you know, a supernatural authority, godly authority, absolute truth. There is an absolute truth. It exists for all places, all people, all time. Truth is truth is truth. This idea leads us to an absolutism in terms of our understanding about how we can live that. Because if we are created in the image of God and therefore meant to be living absolute truth, you would assume that the approach we take to that would be an absolutist approach. But it's not as simple as that. And what tends to happen is that from philosophies we then create theories. Okay, so if this is the general philosophy, how do we ethically live? How do we find ways of saying this is, therefore this is something that we need to do and how we should live? And then from those theories come particular frameworks and approaches, the more practical everyday how we might do things. So if we think about this in this sense, you've got this idea that there is a God and absolute truth exists and therefore absolutism. But therefore, how do we work this out? So there are several approaches, and the same on the other side, approaches that are generalist. Now, I'm not going to go through all of those because that would take me forever. And I think the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, we can live life in a legalistic, theistic kind of way, or we can live life in a way that gives us some sense of understanding what truth is and agreeing to a sense of an absolute truth without necessarily straying into relativism, you know, everything is just situational and doesn't really matter and contextual and whatever. How do we bring this reality of context into a sense of how we can live? And what I'm positing in my paper is that graded absolutism is a good way to do that. If I look at
10 minutes.
Oh no, I need to do an activity now. No, joking. All right. If we look at these areas, we will see antinomian. This is again a snapshot. Antinomianism denies that human laws exist, denies that ethical laws exist, denies that moral capacity exists. Generalism allows laws and standards, but they are devoid of morality. Situationism will say that there is only one moral law, and that is love, but the problem with that is that there's no agreed definition about that. Unqualified absolutism will say that there are many moral laws. Humans can consistently and equally uphold them all. So you see, what we're doing is, if I go back, we're looking at these particular approaches here. Unqualified absolutism is unqualified. There are laws. Laws exist, moral laws exist, and we must live them, and we must live them perfectly and absolutely. Situationism says, you know, there's only one law, and that is love. And you must do the most loving thing, the ethical thing to do, the right thing to do is the most loving thing to do in any particular situation. So on and so forth. So you can see that's what we're looking at here. Conflicting absolutism acknowledges that there is conflict between many moral laws. There is truth. there are moral laws, they do exist, we should live by them, there are many of them, but what do we do when they conflict? Can we keep all of the moral laws all of the time at any given point? Conflicting absolutism says, no, obviously we can't. We live in a relative world. We are not God. We cannot live as if we are. So therefore, it's a deficit approach. The deficit approach is, if you're in a situation where, you know, you have to break a moral law, and you think about Rahab's situation, for example, she is faced with breaking moral laws. Okay? She chooses to lie. She breaks that law. A conflicting absolutism approach would say it's a deficit approach, as in, what can you get away with? What is the least of the laws that you can get away with? So this is the idea that there is a hierarchy of laws. So, and we tend to think about that in terms of the Ten Commandments, don't we? You know, so there's law number one, God is God is God. We have no other gods before us. Number two, three, all the way down to the bottom. And we look at them very much as, you know, well, the ones at the bottom are perhaps the least important compared to the ones at the top. So if we keep that sense here, then really it's, you know, conflicting absolutism says, okay, there's a hierarchy. You have to decide which ones you're going to keep. Make sure you keep the top ones. And if you have to break the bottom ones, well, you know, what's the least you can get away with? We're supposed to keep them all. But, you know, there are times when we can't. Graded absolutism, however, I think is a different kettle of fish. Graded absolutism has this idea that there is a divine standard of truth. There are many absolute laws. Those laws do conflict. And humans are incapable of always keeping all moral laws. So the idea here is a more positive view and a more relational view that our responsibility is to keep the higher law. Okay, to keep the higher law with a reasonable expectation that forgiveness is there already in our righteousness in Christ to be able to find ways to live. George Knight sometimes refers to graded absolutism as limited absolutism. It accepts that there is a hierarchy. Hello, welcome. It accepts that there is a hierarchy. It accepts that there is a deeper understanding, perhaps, that we need, particularly in terms of the commandments, the laws. And one of the things I do with my students is I give them an exercise where we go through the Ten Commandments. And we talk about the fact that there is one law at the top, that is the law to be maintained, which is the law that God is God and that we have no other gods before God. And that is the law that Rahab, in our example, kept. She had that divine sense of the essence of God, the personhood of God. She accepted that that was the main law to keep, and then she acted on the basis of that with full knowledge and full trust and full hope that she would be forgiven for not keeping the lesser law. Okay. So I have one thing I want to do then, and that is just to link this to the idea of hospitality. I've talked about Rahab's action as an act of hospitality. Nguyen talks about hospitality. He says the paradox of hospitality is it wants to create an emptiness, not a fearful emptiness, but a friendly emptiness, where strangers can enter and discover themselves created free, free to sing their own songs, speak their own languages, dance their own dances, free also to leave and follow their own vocations. Hospitality is not a subtle invitation to adopt the lifestyle of the host, but the gift of a chance for the guest to find his or her own. Rahab's actions were very much based on that sense of the essence of God and understanding that her act of hospitality mirrored the hospitality that God has shown to us. If you have a look on the handouts that are on the table there, some of you have taken those. On the very back page, there is a little exercise there. The exercise is one where you can, in the blank spaces, write in your own life's work, your own context, your own vocational context into that, to have that sense of what hospitality really means. I've given an example there below. The bottom one says, the paradox of hospitality is a pedagogical approach is it wants to create an emptiness, blah, 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 but a friendly emptiness, learning spaces where strangers, learners, can enter. And so I've taken that education focus and added that in. And I invite you to take that away. I was going to do that here, but obviously I raved on way too long. But that is something perhaps if you're interested in. And then have a think about that sense of hospitality and Rahab's story being an act of graded absolutism that reflects her understanding of the essence of God. Thank you.
Just when you thought you were going to be hungry for lunch, you've got enough to chew on there from that for now. If anyone would like to actually go through the session, please feel free to move fairly briefly out there. But I want to introduce and welcome Benedict to our workshop this afternoon. I was telling him that I was reading out the titles of the workshops that I'm moderating today to my teenage sons. And I got partway through Benedict's title, The Gospel of Darkness, John of the Cross's contemplative account of the dark night. And at that point, my teenage son was experiencing a Batman happening in a spirituality conference, and I didn't want to burst his bubble. I said yes, and the Joker might be there as well. But I'm going to hand it over to Benedict. Welcome, especially to our international guest. Fantastic to have you. Can you give him a big welcome?
I can figure out this lapel mic here.
There's a couple of chairs. There are some chairs for people who are standing. Don't feel shy. Come sit down. One down here, one there.
How's the audio? Is it okay?
Yeah.
Good?
Yep.
Yeah. Great. Well, I'm so excited to be here on the other side of the world with all of you and to share kind of a strange gospel, good news of spiritual darkness. And that's part of my question today is, in what sense is the tradition of spiritual darkness good news for kind of the postmodern seeker? My title would take me more than 10 minutes to read, so I'm going to skip the title and we're going to get right into it. Just a quick note, though, for those of you who don't know, this is Salvador Dalí's. This is actually based on a sketch by John of the Cross and Dalí's interpretation of it. Stunning, and there's a lot to think about there, but we're going to move straight forward. Okay, so here's my pitch. When I was trying to think about the postmodern seeker and Christian spirituality for the postmodern seeker, I started reading this book. It's called Strange Rites by Tara Isabella Burton. Has anybody read this or heard of it? So it came out in 2020. It's made a bit of a splash in the U.S. It's basically like a theologically astute sociology of the contemporary kind of religious and spiritual landscape in the U.S. It's fascinating. It's very smart and erudite, and Burton is a novelist, and she's very plugged in. This is based on her dissertation at Oxford. One of the things that stood out to me, I've just been kind of plowing through it, is the what I'm calling kind of traces of the golden rule in the contemporary landscape. And again, this is very distinctly based on the U.S. and U.S. culture, so I'd be very interested from international perspectives of, like, does this apply? What applies? What doesn't? And what are the complexities of that? So I really invite that, especially in our discussion, to get into what the nuances are there. But so take that with a lot of grains of salt. This is kind of from an analysis of the conditions of the U.S. One of the things that's interesting, so she's focusing a lot on the nuns, right? The people who on a survey will say that they're not religious, that none applies. What's funny about them, one of the interesting things that she points out is that 72% of them in the U.S. are believe in a higher power and are hungry for contact with a higher power. So that struck me immediately as like, okay, love of God, right? The first kind of pillar of the golden rule. There's an analogy. There's a way that that's alive in the culture. Another big thing that she focuses on is social justice activism and the way that that kind of functions religiously in the landscape in the U.S. And that really ties into love of neighbor and even kind of historically the way that kind of like Christian socialism and all these kind of historical movements that have given birth to what today is kind of social justice activism in the U.S., there's even historical roots for the kind of second pillar of the Golden Rule as an origin for that. So that was kind of my starting point of like, okay, these traces of the Golden Rule are active. And so how do we, as theologians, how can we capitalize on that and also understand it and engage with it in a responsible and nuanced way? Now, this kind of got me into the problematic that kind of turned me to spiritual darkness, which is Burton's argument is that, again, in the U.S., there's a deep strain of what she calls intuitional religion as kind of a basis that goes deep in American culture, and she kind of traces it through the Great Awakenings. And one of the key components of this is a focus on experience and lived experience as a basis for religion, as a guide for religion or spirituality. And she argues that that's very, very operative in kind of the broad religion of the nuns or spirituality of the nuns in the U.S. So what was fascinating to me is then thinking about how is that going to interact with these kind of traces of the Golden Rule, particularly like, look, if you believe in some kind of a higher power and you hunger for the higher power, what happens when you don't experience the higher power? What do you do with that? And then the same with justice. If you believe that we can create a more just order and you're trying and it's not working, what do you do? And so that's what kind of called me back to the tradition of spiritual darkness. And what does this have to say to this problematic? So I'm taking kind of, I mean, my little 10-minute stab at a starting point. Now, as the title says, this is about John of the Cross, but in 10 minutes, it's actually not really that much about John of the Cross. It's about how to translate John of the Cross into a contemporary context. Here's the problem. John of the Cross writes for a very specific audience. He's generally speaking to contemplatives, which is a specific calling. He focuses kind of the lion's share of his discussion of darkness on states of darkness that he himself thinks are fairly unusual. So like the passive night of the spirit, he thinks is quite rare. But then even in kind of, let's say, the earlier stages of darkness, the dark night of the, let's say the active night of the senses, that's kind of step one for John. That's still in a very specific Catholic faith context for him. And he's reading that theologically with very specific kind of rules of engagement. And so translating it out of that environment is not completely straightforward in any way. And there was with COVID, there was a kind of new rash of really good research on the Dark Night and how it's so common in our speech and so misunderstood and how to kind of adjudicate that and use it rightly. Specifically, Stephen Payne, a Carmelite scholar, he wrote something in 2021 that's very helpful. So if you're interested in that, we could talk more. But he kind of establishes some principles of how do we adjudicate translating the Dark Night for a contemporary audience. What I'm focusing on is there's a French phenomenologist, kind of one of the leaders of French phenomenology right now, Jean-Yves Lacoste. And he, in a very philosophical vein, engaging with postmodern thought, specifically in a European continental setting, so again, lots of grains of salt, he talks about the Dark Night. And I'm going to focus on his translation. I don't think it's fully adequate, but I think it's very interesting and a good starting point. The inadequacies I want to talk about more after my presentation. So I'm going to focus more on some basics of what he says and let that kind of be a starting point for us. Okay, so where does he start? He starts with what I'm calling cracks in the buffered self. So in the kind of self-contained postmodern kind of monadal self, what are the things that are opening us up to this hunger for the absolute? He focuses on two things. One is restlessness. He devotes the book that he talks about this. He dedicates it to Henri de Lubac. So clearly that's in the background in his concept of restlessness. He also, and I think this is really smart from a philosophical perspective, he talks about historical mediations, what I'm calling rumors, of the absolute who is personal. We live in a world where things have happened and where ideas have been shared. And so he thinks kind of the postmodern self has heard about God, right? And that we actually need to take that into account philosophically. And we shouldn't limit ourselves to a priorities that are completely ahistorical. So it's an interesting philosophical starting point. We could talk about that some more. Now, another one of his, he's a lover of Heidegger, which is interesting as a Catholic priest and theologian. But he's a very interesting he engages Heidegger in a very interesting way. He thinks that Heidegger has kind of accurately summed up what we consider as postmoderns, what we consider as what counts as experience. And so that's kind of his, he thinks the analysis of Dasein has kind of put a finger on, this is what we think experience is. And according to that kind of definition of experience, Lacoste doesn't think these rumors of the absolute was personal, he doesn't think those show up, that the absolute shows up in experience defined broadly in a contemporary postmodern setting. So, I mean, we could think of that even just kind of like, okay, if we think of this historical mediation as like a spiritual immaterial being, and we tend to think of experience in very empirical terms, there's going to be some problems there of God. What would it mean for God to show up in that kind of experience? Another thing that he focuses on is that our sense of experience is tied up with a sense of control. We can think of this in a lot of different ways, even in kind of the way that scientism is kind of, and the scientific method has kind of imbued our culture. We like repetition. We like to be able to reproduce things. And if there is an absolute who is personal, then what about the absolute's freedom? And how is that going to engage with the absolute manifesting, choosing to manifest in our experience or choosing not to? So he thinks this is a big problem. And this is the basic solution that he wants to offer. And again, he wants to offer this on a philosophical level, on a much broader than kind of Christian theology, even though it's clearly very influenced by Christian theology. He uses the word liturgy. He uses it in this very broad, kind of sui generis way. But what he talks about is that he thinks it's of the essence of human nature to be able to define the horizon of what you think reality is beyond what you've already experienced. Right, that we can imagine, we can hope for conditions and experiences that we haven't experienced yet. We can imagine conditions in a society that we haven't realized yet, and the ability to live according to coordinates that go beyond our experience and our actions is part of the essence of what it is to be human. And I think that there's something quite compelling there, and he uses that as an openness. And he says, for those who, he thinks it's always a choice, he thinks it's an option, but he thinks you can choose to live according to the coordinates of what the world defined by the absolute who is personal might be. So he thinks you can kind of set that over yourself and live into that regardless of whether the absolute has come into experience for you or not. So he calls this liturgy. And I think that it's quirky, but it's a very interesting way to think about it. So this is a Georgian Orthodox modern stylite. So somebody who's living on a pillar in a tiny little... Lacoste uses this, the idea of the recluse, as an example of somebody who's living in a way that doesn't make sense according to kind of postmodern definitions of experience. They're coordinating their life according to a framework where, like, that's weird. To do that doesn't make a lot of sense. But Lacoste's argument is that opens up a new space. Okay, so this gets into, I think, the two really good, solid contributions of Lacoste on darkness, and then we can talk more about the adequacies and inadequacies of this. But he talks about two things that I think are really helpful. He thinks that spiritual darkness can be defined according to inexperience and inoperativity. So inexperience, for Lacoste, is the cost to religious experience, to our sense of what we can or have already experienced, the cost of risking living into this new frame of coordinates. He thinks that if you don't let inexperience speak, you can't really let God be God in your life. And so I think he's trying to apply this to like the broadest possible kind of like postmodern audience. But what I would want to say is that there's a rhythm of this in a spiritual life, right? And what we kind of arrive at in terms of experience of God, then there's kind of a negative movement where we have to be ready to be open to something more. And that's part of kind of the earthly journey. And then in kind of the ethical vein. So if that's kind of the love of God negativity, then what about the love of neighbor negativity? He talks about, I love this, he talks about the vigil as the time that you take when you've fulfilled your obligations and you take time from sleep, something that you need and deserve. You take some of it, not enough to kind of hurt yourself, but enough where you've fulfilled your duties. You're going to take something away from sleep. And in the surplus of that, where you're saying, look, I'm more than my biological necessity, you're going to open yourself to the horizon of being before God. And you're going to open yourself with an eye towards ethical change, with an eye towards justice for neighbor, in the realization that you failed during the day to accomplish all that your neighbor deserves. And he thinks that in that time of inoperativity, in the vigil, is where you're able to consider what's going on in a bigger frame. You're able to ask forgiveness. You're able to imagine a kingdom. And you're able to rest and wait, and then go back to work the next day. So he thinks for the love of neighbor that this is a necessary component. That if we only try to work for our neighbor according to the coordinates of the world that is already broken, and don't spend time in coordinates of hope in a less broken world when we're not doing anything and we're frustrated by that, that we're not going to be able to imagine the way out that our neighbor deserves. Now, I think something that's important is he thinks that there's then a spiritual journey that's involved, right? So in terms of love of God, he thinks that, you know, if we start with a notion of experience that can't include the absolute, but then we lean into it, we let inexperience speak, maybe there's more. He thinks that discernment is kind of the classic Christian answer of like, hey, you can start to think about your experience of the absolute in mediated terms through discernment. And then mysticism as something that he thinks is more unusual, but then something where the absolute is arising in something like a more immediate experience. And he talks about the realization of the kingdom in ethical terms, right? That through the vigil and then through our work, that the kingdom does start to be realized. And so there are these mediations, but he thinks that these elements of darkness are the conditions of the possibility of the fullest possible growth. Okay, so that's Lacoste, and we're 13 minutes in. So I'd like to move on to questions. I've framed a couple questions here. I'll read a few to you, but I really want to open it up to your questions first and foremost, and then we can dive into these if you need them. The first one is kind of what's missing from Lacoste. As somebody who studies John of the Cross, there's alarm bells going. There's like things that I want to add, but I want to hear like some of the things that you might think are missing, and we can discuss that a little bit. Then, what about rules for discernment? I feel like the minute you want to talk about spiritual darkness, you have to talk about discerning, right? Because what's the difference between spiritual darkness that's going to lead to transformation and clinical depression, right, or despair? Speaking for myself, what about laziness? And how does that function? If we get to it, another interesting question is, what about how we understand experience? And is it helpful to think about kind of broad, lowest common denominator, postmodern experience as atheistic? Is that helpful? Is that unhelpful? So anyways, these are a couple questions to get us started. I have a couple more questions if we breeze through these, but what do you all think? What are some of your thoughts and questions of this way of trying to translate spiritual darkness? Yeah?
I think this is the first time at this conference I've heard that the norms being mentioned, and I think it's something that we actually need to be doing a lot more thinking and talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I really recommend Strange Rights. It's a strange book, too, because I think the U.S. is a strange place right now. But it really a very... broad and insightful analysis of the nuns. And one of her big pitches is that it's wrong to think of them, in her terms, as irreligious. She thinks they're kind of a very religious bunch. And she actually, one of the things that's fascinating is that they pray, like the nuns in the U.S. pray as much as the Christians in Europe. And so that's kind of the like baseline, right? And so I think that's very helpful to kind of reframe the nuns as like actually a very actively religious group. That's doing religion, she calls it remix religion, that they're doing this kind of very different form of religion, but that we should think of it in those terms. So, yeah. Yeah?
I'm hearing this through the lens of Charles Taylor to some degree.
Yes.
I mean, he used the term fragilization, which occurs to me a helpful term, but a difficult term for many Christians.
Yeah.
That somehow fragility in terms of conviction, even belief system.
Fascinating. Yeah.
It's hard to conceive that might be a positive, and yet, in terms of connecting with a wider world, it might be the point of deepest connection.
That's a really cool thought, because I feel like that fragility, when read in the tradition of apophaticism, can be helpful, of how do you lean into what you're uncertain about to start a journey, right? And I think the danger is that when it's instead like an excuse for not looking, right, and leads to despair instead of motivation. But I think when that fragility could be kind of lead into in apathetic terms.
Maybe even be liturgical.
Absolutely. Yeah, great.
Like that might be the starting point of our worship.
Yeah. And that's Lacoste's whole point, right?
I don't know anything like this.
Yeah. One of his most compelling ideas is the importance of boredom in the liturgy, right? So he translates like the darkness, liturgical darkness, into boredom of like, and I think that's really nice because, like, when you're in a liturgy, you're kind of stuck, right? You can't just like go and make your own fun and read something more interesting or try again, you know. And that boredom discerned correctly is a longing, And longing is like the heart of the apophatic tradition. Yeah, so that's really good. That's really good. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I actually love the answer to that simple question. I think that's a really excellent.
Yeah, what are some of your thoughts about it?
It's not really an answer, but the first question that comes to mind is how important those rules of discernment are.
Yeah.
That was the thing that came to me. It was just you can't go into the dark night of the soul without that.
Totally.
But yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about it.
One of my, and this is one of my kind of, he's using it for his own purposes, so it's not so much a critique of Lacoste, but a critique of this as a full account of spiritual darkness, is that for John on the Cross, darkness is always a moment at the service of transformation, and it's both leading to somewhere better, but it's also motivated by love. And I think that's something that is, to me, the biggest missing piece, is like that motivation from love that pushes you into a place of darkness, right? It's a hunger for contact with the absolute that leads you there. And to get through it, you have to know how to feed that hunger. And I think that's a really important thing of like, what does it take? So to me, like one of the things I was thinking of in the longer paper, I turned to Gustavo Gutierrez's reading of John of the Cross, and he talks about the motivation that the recognition of God's gratuity provides. So like gratitude, and even very broad practices of gratitude is like, how do you, because like, again, darkness for darkness' sake, that doesn't mean anything, right? That's not how the cross functions. That's not a Christian, I don't think a Christian idea. So I think that gratitude can provide maybe some of that broad motivational structure of like, yes, I'm grateful for this potential absolute who is personal, who I haven't experienced, but I feel some kind of, and gratitude I think is kind of a relational concept, right? You're not grateful to nothing. You're grateful to someone, something. And so maybe that's a way. So I think that's one of the discernment things of like, is your darkness motivated by love? You know? Another thing that's really important is one of the things that Stephen Payne talks about is that, is it in a real sense purgative? So is it leading you somewhere good? Is it helping you? Is it changing you? Because if it's not, like, you don't want to take tragedy and then like say, oh, God's just purging you. You know, like it's more complex than that. And you could really turn that. I think feminist theologians talking about John of the Cross and darkness and potential pitfalls is like, do you just turn this into kind of like an excuse to stay in the conditions of suffering that you're in? Mm-hmm. And I think purgation is a key thing there. We have time?
Yeah. I would say one good rule.
Oh, great, yeah.
Is get yourself a spiritual director.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Just think about the nature of communal discernment. Like, it almost reads like, well, I've got to get my rules sorted before I go.
Yeah.
And you can't see what you don't know.
Totally.
And so having that skilled intervention.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That prayerful contemplative intervention to help particularly, you actually need... This sounds like depression.
Yeah.
You need to go and see Or, okay, let's actually see if we can have the courage to lean into this.
Yeah.
Because of what might be on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, and thank you. And John of the Cross is all over that. He thinks that that's critical. And a lot of what he writes is actually meant for spiritual directors. That was his main ministry in life, right, was as a spiritual director. So that's a critical point. Do this in community. Don't be in darkness alone. That's not good. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you. Are we at time?
20? Yeah, a couple more minutes.
Okay. Yeah, any other questions or? Yeah, please.
I'm curious though that the poem The Dark Knight comes out of his trauma.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do with that? It's not, you know, trundling along in my spiritual life and, you know, suddenly God is revealed as utterly, you know, other and in darkness. No. This poem came out of an experience of being tortured.
Torture, absolutely.
It's a trauma.
Yeah.
So,
there's so much to talk about that. It's such a great question. I think there's a few interesting things. One thing is that John of the Cross escaped, right? So he was being tortured and he said, they're going to kill me. I need to get out, right? And so I think that that's important, is that he was not qua trauma. He did not go through it passively as in, oh, this is just what I deserve. God is purging me. He got out, right? And it was a long planned risky escape. And so I think that's one lens to look at the purgative element. Because then when he talks about the dark night of the soul, particularly, well, yeah, all through the passive nights, he never uses his trauma as the lens to understand it. And I think it's precisely because of this danger that you would turn something that is not a purgative gift of God in a straightforward sense into, oh, you know, God's just trying me, you know? So I think that part of his, you know, so for John of the Cross, the Dark Night of the Spirit is a gift. Basically, it's God is giving you a new form of prayer, a contemplative infusion. It's actually, John thinks it's really light. And because of two things, he kind of dips into the two traditional categories of grace, elevating and healing. And he thinks that the dark night is like the dark side of the process of elevating and healing when you receive this contemplative gift from God. And so there's an ontological gap. You're now being invited to participate in God's activities, which utterly transcend yours. And then there's this moral gap, which is that this light, what you first see is yourself, and you see your sins in the light of God. And he thinks those are the two fundamental principles that make this so brutally dark. But it's all predicated on this radical new gift of God. And so it's not predicated on your brothers torturing you, right? It's predicated on something that God is doing. And so those are some rules for discerning, you know, when it's, I mean, he was literally beaten twice a week by his brothers. He had wounds from the lashings that lasted for months and months afterwards. He's on death's door when he got out. So yeah, that's an incredibly important question, and those are a few kind of starting points for that. Thank you for that question.
Benedict, you might have people lining up to have lunch with you, I think. That was just fascinating and rich and wonderful, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Absolutely, yes.
By all means, you are welcome to do that.
Okay, and I'll get rid of myself.
Yeah.
Is this good?
Yeah.
Yep. Here, I'm going to bring yours up. You focus on how.
Oh, hey. Trying to get the tick. Oh, great.
So, welcome to Robin. Exploring it.
Oh, wait. How do I go the other direction? Yep. Oh, good. Oh, I can drive it. Great. Hi, everyone. I want to start by honouring, and I'll probably cry, Reverend Professor Austin Cooper, who, if you didn't know him, you missed out on a very remarkable Australian who was a professor of spirituality who died just on Sunday. And Austin was my friend. And, yeah, just a few weeks ago, we had this beautiful long conversation on the phone about Mary, because I'd been on the Camino and I'd seen all these representations of Mary. And I suppose I want to honour him, because we're all interested in spirituality and we're based in Australia. And Austin, to me, was one of the great teachers of Christian spirituality in this land for decades. And as I think of Austin, I think of a very gentle man. Gentleness is essential to good teaching of Christian spirituality. And he was a gentleman. The first time I met him, 2007, he hosted me in his CTC office, and he had handmade sandwiches and a pot of tea. And right now, Austin Cooper is with the Cloud of Witnesses, and it's my bet that he's having a cup of tea with Evelyn Underhill. Because it's beyond time. Eternity's beyond time. And he is there in the Cloud of Witnesses. And I just want to honour a truly wonderful Christian teacher in spirituality who befriended me, and I'm deeply humbled by that. So we both had a love of Evelyn Underhill. So that's a bit of a bond there. So I start with, I've got to get this going the right direction. There we go. I start with a quote from Evelyn Underhill. If you haven't met this woman, get to know her, because she's fabulous. She was born in 1875 and died in 1941. And I start with this quote. She says, "God is present to us in the souls of our fellow men and women. This is a discovery of the very essence of love. Our hearts are as great as our love. Our hearts are as great as our love." My paper focuses on the centrality of love, especially the link between loving God and loving neighbour. Christ models for us generous love. And yet his words about loving neighbour, they're so basic, but it's so hard to do it. And sadly and tragically, the church is really bad at it. In fact, the church is really bad at loving the church, right? And so one of the things that I think is a real off-put to anyone in the contemporary world is the fact that the church fights, points fingers all the time. It's them and us and all this sort of stuff. It's just such an off-put for anyone in the contemporary world. They're quite happy to talk about Jesus, maybe, or spirit, but the church, forget it, because of all this fighting and all this, I've got it right, you've got it wrong, in, out, all this stuff. So, a lot of contemporary seekers not only find the church pretty revolting, but they think it's kind of irrelevant because so many of the issues of our time, the church actually isn't on the whole that interested in. Think about our fragile ecosystems and what's happening in the world. On the whole, the people that are driving that are people outside of the church. They're driving the recovery, not the people in the church. Think about this whole idea of loving others and the fact that there's a lot of pretty ugly homophobia, transphobia, and racism and sexism in the church, right? Like, what's going on with this love of neighbour as self? So if a lack of love is a fundamental issue alienating contemporary seekers from engaging with Christian spirituality, how might we address this problem? What needs to change so that pathways can be created that draw seekers to encounter Christ, the source of love? Oh, I'm going the wrong direction, sorry. I want to suggest that spiritual ecumenism is one way forward. And my friend Evelyn Underhill was passionate about praying for church unity. Often when we think about ecumenism, we think about people having these big discussions and think tanks and they're all around the table and everybody's arguing about what, is there anything that we can agree with? This is very different. Spiritual ecumenism is basically saying, you know what? Jesus' prayer was that they might be one. Unity is something of the Spirit. The Spirit brings about unity of the church. And in fact, the triune God loves the unity of the church. So the only way it can happen, that's not to diminish the think tanks, I'm not bagging them out, but this is something different. This is about an undercurrent prayer for unity in the church where people come together and it's like leaven in the dough. It's just this infiltration. And Evelyn was involved in it for a long time. And it's hard to know how little or how much to do this in what I've got to say, but I do want to say a tiny little bit about her as a spiritual ecumenist. So even though she's brought up in a secular home, and I'm going to race now, so just hold on, Italian art got her into Christianity, and then in 1919, she's brought into contact with this wonderful Italian Franciscan nun called Sorella Maria by an English friend of hers, a nurse, who was working in Siena, Amy Turton. The three of them get together and they decide they will be what's called the Spiritual Entente, a group of denominationally diverse, geographically dispersed Christians that join together through an invisible link of prayer. The goal, quote, to increase love, understanding and unity between church traditions. Now, for some reason, Evelyn, she's a great writer, 1920, she gets the job of writing the leaflet that talks about, well, what are we all about as a spiritual entente? And basically, one of the things in the leaflet is they say we've got to be loyal to our own church traditions or affiliation, but the central object of the spiritual entente, this prayer movement, is, quote, hastening the kingdom of God through prayer for unity. But Evelyn argued this really involves the kingdom invading our order, invading our lives, redeeming us, the serenity of God enfolding us. And key to that transformation is the Spirit reordering our love from self-absorption and self-love to love of God and the other. And it's also about self-offering and hospitality for God's purposes. Evelyn wrote, quote, hard judgment opposes the coming of the kingdom, hence the necessity for spiritual understanding. So each member was to look for Christ in the other and then diffuse this unifying spirit around them. They were to reverence all forms of worship, living out the conviction that God leads people by different roads to the one fold with Jesus, the one shepherd. Now, later on in her life in World War II, Evelyn was actually part of what was called Abbé Couturier. He was a French Catholic priest, and what was called the Reunion Movement. This was joining in 40 days of prayer for church unity. And then not long after Evelyn's death in 1941, Couturier's movement actually became what was called the Invisible Monastery, a global movement of Christians praying for church unity. Couturier saw this cloister, quote, living in the Christ who prays for unity, uniting Christians with, quote, the same love before uniting them in the same faith. Do you hear this? Uniting in the same love. Spiritual understanding coming together with the big things that matter. So I'm going to pause for a moment and I want you at your tables just to reflect together on what I've talked about so far about spiritual ecumenism, this idea of global communities of Christians from all different versions of Christianity praying together for some sense of unity. And I'm only going to give you about 3 minutes. So go for it.
Your way of having it.
Okay, if I can just interrupt everybody. It sounds to me like, it sounds to me like there's enough that I've presented to talk about, but I'm going to give you a bit more. So, sorry, you're stuck with it. It's on the same theme. I want to talk a little bit about some of the principles in Evelyn Underhill's radio talk she gave on the BBC in 1936 that were then published the next year as The Spiritual Life in 1937. Because it actually relates to what we're talking about here, about love of God and love of others. She never talks about spiritual ecumenism or something like that, but she knows that her audience is just whoever's tuning into the BBC as she gives these talks. So she doesn't use technical language. She doesn't use all the Christian speak that's going to alienate people. She's just kind of herself. And it's actually just quite beautiful to read. But it's interesting because she's really talking about two things in the talks. If you boil it down, it's this stuff. From self-absorbed self-love, and really, are the church any different to the rest of the population when it comes to this stuff, turned in on ourselves? And then, as we get the gaze there and there, we can love others well. And when she's talking about moving from self-absorbed self-love to love of God, she's actually drawing upon Berul, who has this idea of adoration, communion and cooperation. And adoration is all about my Lord and my God. Wow, like you are huge. Wow, that's adoration. Communion is this intimate communion with the triune God. So these are both about God. She starts with God. She's not starting with grit your teeth and love that person you can't stand. She's starting with God. You get this stuff right, you can do this stuff. Cooperation is this idea that God is doing stuff in the world all the time, everywhere. Not just in me, not just in the church, but out there, everywhere. He's doing stuff all the time. And we, as lovers of God, are invited to cooperate with what he's doing. And that cooperation isn't just, oh, I suddenly thought I should help that one or whatever. It's also prayer. Praying for people, intercession. And she's not just calling it, these crazy lists that's just whatever, but this sense of being drawn into praying earnestly for something that God puts on your heart. I'll give you a funny example. It's not really a funny example, it's a tragic example, but a bunch of years ago, I don't know when, I remember reading a news article about a young girl, I think she was 12, who'd been raped by Boko Haram, I think that's how you say it, in Africa. And the aid workers were trying to counsel this girl who was saying, no, I didn't get raped, because the shame is so great. Now, because I have daughters, I was so struck by this poor little girl, and I was just praying for her and weeping for her. Who knows what the effect of that prayer on this girl's life is? It doesn't really matter. But I was drawn into praying and weeping for this little girl. Because I have daughters, right? It touches the mother heart. That's cooperation. Prayer matters. Prayer does stuff. It's not just, and I'm not belittling get in there with your boots and your whatever, but, you know, we are to cooperate with what God is doing in the world as the Spirit works everywhere, all the time, bringing about redemption. Secondly, she's talking about shifting from individualism to think as moderns. It's all about me or it's all about these little. But no, it's all about everybody. We're all connected. All souls are deeply interconnected, is what von Hugel said. And von Hugel was Evelyn's main spiritual director. So loving people in the present, whoever they are, wherever they are, not just in my little clique, not just in my little churchy club, everywhere. It doesn't matter who they are, just love them in our unique ways. And loving the historic community of saints, the communion of saints, the cloud of witnesses. These Christians accompany us in the present. So one thing I love about Evelyn is she talks about this whole idea of the invisible church and the visible church. The visible church is the here and now. It's the people in the room, it's the people in the newspapers, it's whatever. The visible church, the invisible church is outside of time. It's all those wonderful Christians that we read and get inspired by. And, you know, I started by honouring one of them today. He's part of the cloud of witnesses. So, moving from individualism to community. And then she's talking about love and church unity. So, adoration of God is actually the foundation for spiritual ecumenism. We can only truly love others in the church when we are actually adoring God and get some of that into our hearts for loving others. And I was just recently reading The Four Loves, where C.S. Lewis at the end talks about supernatural love that comes to us from God so that we can love the unlovely and the people that completely get up our noses. That's my version of what he's saying. But you know, the people that you just go, gee, I find it hard to like that person. But with God's love, we are enabled to love people that we find really difficult. So, love and church unity. So I'll read my last little bit. I remember a song in the 1960s by Peter Schultz. He says, "We are one in the Spirit. We are one in the Lord." You know that song? We are one in the Spirit. And they'll know we are Christians by our love. It's kind of a daggy little song. But as I was sort of thinking about this, it's like, it's actually, they'll know we are Christians by our love. And the more we see churches splitting and splintering, and the more we see things in the paper that kind of make the public go, whatever. You just have to read the comment sections of the Sydney Morning Herald when there's something about church or religion to see what people out there are thinking church is about. So I find myself thinking that perhaps now is the time that once again we become the invisible cloister, living in the Christ who prays for unity, uniting in the same love. Perhaps this is the time to intentionally cultivate online communities of prayer through email and Zoom gatherings. And like the spiritual entente, make the increase of love, spiritual understanding, and Christian unity our goal. Perhaps it's also the time when, like Evelyn Underhill, who actually tried quite explicitly to get inside the practices, the worship practices and the understandings in different branches of the church through actually worshipping in those churches so she could understand them and write about them in her book, Worship, published in 1936. Perhaps it's a time to actually experience worship in other contexts of the church, as opposed to stand outside and just go, that's weird. Actually, join in and see what it's all about. A Christian spirituality that responds to our time needs to embody openness, kindness, and a compassionate embrace for the many different versions of Christianity. We're called to love others, and that includes the body of Christ, both the visible and invisible church. Ultimately, the Spirit is the one who enables this unifying, generous love, breaking down barriers created through our fear, hear that, fear, and ignorance. Uniting hearts in spiritual understanding, healing hurts, overcoming prejudices, and helping us to repent of past errors. The Spirit also helps us cease being competitive. Yeah. Doesn't the church love to compete with each other?
Yes.
Bag them so that we can, you know. It's like, it's not a competition. And it's not about the money. Let's just get this right. So, it's about not being competitive, rejoicing in and receiving the gifts of others. Rather than ignorant critique, unkind slander, mudslinging, authentic unity begins with union in prayer, which then spreads to the surface. As Evelyn Underhill argued, with eyes cleansed by prayer, we're able to read the letters of the name wherever found and in whatever script. So I'll just let some of that sink in. And I don't have any questions prepared for you, so feel free to tell the person next to you, I didn't understand any of that. Or ask me a question if you'd like. I don't know how we're going for time.
Yeah, a couple of minutes. So that would be a good opportunity if anyone wants to feedback, a comment or a question. That would be wonderful. A thought or a question.
Yeah.
It's probably a reflective question more than anything, but there's a question of adoration, and knowing the adoration prayer that goes, we adore you, O Christ. But is adoration more than just the word?
I think adoration is a posture. I think because we're naturally bent in on ourselves, we're just back here with the self-absorption stuff. And the reason Evelyn's good on this is because if you read her personal journals, of course, she never knew would get published by my lovely friend Dana Green, but they're published. There's just so much self-absorption, right? So she gets that because she lived that, and it's about that and knowing that. So it's a posture. It's not just saying liturgy, although liturgy helps us in the posture. Being together with other people helps us in the posture, but it's like, wow, that's adoration for me. So it's a posture, it's a shifting of the gaze. It's what we see, it's how we see everything. Anyone else? Yeah.
Just want to ask a question about the sense of, if I'm quoting you correctly, forgive me, prayer matters and prayer does stuff, and yet the illustration of, I don't actually know what prayer does. And I have an internal struggle. I'm a minister of a small parish, and we tend to, the people with whom I live, work and pray, very quick to say, I'll praise the Lord when something good happens. Nothing. It's crickets when there is no good evidence to say that God's doing anything. And I kind of want to rebel against that sense of, yeah, that, okay, God's actually done something and our prayer has done something. And yet, how do we sit within that paradox that we actually don't know what prayer does? We know prayer matters, but we're not really quite sure how. And in what way can we convey that to our people so that it's more than just this, my own personal perception, which is probably wrong and flawed, this shallow sense of prayer is only worth doing if it achieves something that I can see.
So I think a lot of Christians think that prayer is about twisting God's arm.
Yeah.
It's actually trying to manipulate God. And I suppose when I think about prayer, I think of it not in transactional terms, but actually in formational terms. Yeah. So prayer changes me. If we go back to that illustration of that young girl, who knows whether my tears meant that some aid worker, like, it doesn't matter. I don't care. But in that moment, my heart went out to that young girl. But it also softens my heart because I'm not just thinking, poor me and all my crap, I'm like, fair dinkum, that poor thing, right? My heart's going out to someone else. And so I often think, you know, prayer is formational of communities and of people. And, you know, most of us here find corporate prayer meetings pretty foul because it's very much who can pray the best prayer, performative rubbish. But there's something good about praying with another and being encouraged by praying with another. So there's a sense in which, you know, stuff happens when we pray. We don't understand it because if it was easy enough to understand, I would know how to manipulate the Holy Spirit and God wouldn't be God. I would be equal and I'd just be like, dirt, dirt, dirt. It's like, no, there's mystery around who God is. So there's mystery around how prayer works. But when we pray, and it doesn't have to be this da 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 da, it can be, I'm just in this beautiful, amazing forest or whatever, and I'm so aware of the presence of God. And I'm just going, ah, that's prayer. Beautiful. Oh, my soul is refreshed. And I feel like a lot of the time we've been taught that prayer is like so many words, jabber, 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 and twist the arm and like, please God, bless this, instead of saying, what on earth are you doing, God? What are you doing? What do you want me to do? And it was Eugene Peterson that helped me so much with that. Like this year, this weekly Sabbath, and just stop and look at the last week. What was all that about? Get off the conveyor belt. Just stop. Wow, what was all that about? What are you doing, God? Let me just rest. I'm exhausted. And then kind of get out of the, you know, he talks about getting out of the front seat where we've been driving all week and stop and get in the back seat of the car and just luxuriate for a while. What was all that about? And then we start again. And by the end of the week, we're kind of back in there just churning, driving the car, because we've sort of lost this sense that, in fact, God's doing stuff all the time, and maybe the stuff that we're kind of hurtling down the track with isn't really the most important work right now. So he helps me with
that. That's part of hospitality in prayer, though, isn't it? It's that sense that, you know, that God's genuine acceptance of us is something that we can see and be and follow and, you know, and our prayer in that sense is motivated by that genuine acceptance of others.
Robin, thank you so much for the gift of introducing your friend who may well become our friend, Evelyn Underhill, and just opening that in such a beautiful, artistic and informative way. So thank you so much. Could we give an hour for lunch? We need to be back in the main room at